Welcome.
Welcome to Monsters,
a true crime podcast. I'm Steph.
I'm Rye. Thank you for listening.
Yeah.
You're a monster too.
Yes.
We're all monsters here.
We're all monsters. And today...
Today is a mini monster-sode.
Yeah, we wanted to do a little something different for our 10th episode as we're working on our heavy hitter. We're going to be covering Jeffrey Dahmer in the next coming week.
Stay so that's exciting. Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm excited for that.
And also, don't forget to check our Patreon where you can support us, this very small and humble podcast.
Earn yourself an exclusive episode.
Yes, we're going to be working on exclusive episodes that won't be posted onto this regular podcast, and they will also be ad-free.
You can review us on Apple Podcasts.
Yeah, that's another way of supporting the pod. You can go leave us a 5-star review and leave us an actual comment so we can see what we can improve on or if we're doing good.
Fair enough.
And now we can go into the episode.
The general gist of today is going to be a murder tale from our home states. Those states are Texas, Steph.
Oh, yeah. And Ryan is doing Massachusetts.
Where we are now.
Yes. So I'm going to be covering the case of Andrea Yates. Have you ever heard that name?
No.
It's a very sad case, I think. And it's a very popular case in Texas. It happened in the early 2000s. So it's not in the 80s like most of my cases that I pick. And it's going to be demonstrating how severe postpartum depression and improper psychiatric care can severely affect the life of, like, someone that's seemingly, like, happy and normal.
That seems to be the story of a lot of these serial murderers.
Mm-hmm. They all are suffering of some sort of, like, mental thing. We don't want to, like, label because we don't know. But, yeah, this story, it's really sad, actually. I wanted to begin by clarifying what postpartum depression is. Postpartum depression usually begins within the first 3 months after giving birth. It can remain a long-term problem for some women, especially if they do not receive treatment for it. And according to the National Institute for Mental Health, almost 15% of women experience postpartum depression after giving birth. So it's pretty, I wouldn't say it's pretty common, but it happens. That equates to about 1 in 7 women get postpartum depression. And this is different from baby blues, which it happens to 80% of women after having birth. After you have the baby, you usually feel sad, fatigue, anxiety from having a new baby, but they go away within a few days, like 3 to 5 days. And also in this case, I also wanted to clarify what postpartum psychosis is. Postpartum psychosis is a serious mental health illness that can affect someone soon after having a baby. It can affect around 1 in 500 mothers after giving birth, so it's a little rarer than postpartum depression. And this is a little bit more severe, also, especially if it doesn't get treated properly. The side effects from this, or the symptoms, I mean, are delusions, strange beliefs, hallucinations. You get very irritated. You have hyperactivity. It doesn't end there. You also have the decreased need for or inability to sleep. So now you have sleep deprivation, paranoia, suspiciousness, rapid mood swings, and difficulty communicating at times. So it's all like a whole thing.
Reach out to those women in your life that just had babies.
Yeah, you need to make sure that they are okay. I watch a side note. I watched a YouTuber that I've been watching for a long time, and she had a baby. And then she didn't post for like the longest time. And then when she came back, she told her story, how she had postpartum depression and everything, how much she was struggling. And I don't know. I just think it's an important thing that people don't really talk about.
It is. I agree.
Well, this is going to be part of the story if it's already not a given. We're going to begin. It's in Texas, like I said, in the early 2000s. And Andrea Yates, she was born in Houston, Texas. She was the youngest of 5 children of Judah Karen Kohler, and her dad was Andrew Emmett Kennedy. Not a lot was mentioned about her early childhood, but they did talk about that she was a troubled teenager. She suffered from bulimia, depression, and even at the age of 17, she was already telling friends that she wanted to commit suicide.
Troubled youth.
Yeah, I feel like we all go through those kinds of bouts, but this tells me that at a really young age, she was already predisposed to depression.
You know? Yeah.
that later in life gets aggravated, as we'll see. Despite this, she graduated from Milby High School in 1982, where she was class valedictorian. She was the captain of her swim team, and she was an officer in the National Honor Society. So she was pretty successful. And then after that, she went to college and she completed a 2-year pre-nursing program at the University of Houston. And she graduated from the University of Texas Health Science Center at Houston, where she became a registered nurse.
She was a stand-up girl.
She was. She battled through all of that. She became an RN. And she was an RN from 1986 to 1994 at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center.
Very nice.
Yeah. In the summer of 1989, she met Russell, who we're going to be calling Rusty. That was his name. Yates. And he was a NASA engineer, and they met at their apartment complex in Houston that was called Sunscape Apartments, and they both lived there and they met. They fell in love, they moved in together, and they were married on April 17th of 1993. This is particularly interesting also because once Rusty met Andrea, he introduced her to this travel evangelist named Michael Wernicke, and they both quickly embraced this guy's teachings. You can already tell from here that this is not going to be heading anywhere good because travel evangelists are crazy. And I hope that didn't offend anyone. But Rusty met Michael when he was a student at the Auburn University in Alabama. And soon Rusty became devoted to Michael and Michael's teachings. Michael was at the college campus recruiting new followers. Some of his teachings are seen in a video that you can see online. You can hear Michael tell his followers that, and I quote, "Multitudes are going to hell. God doesn't give a hoot about your little selfish, affluent, self-oriented world," end quote. So you can kind of get an idea of what kind of bullshit this guy was spreading.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't understand, like, what kind of, like, mentality or mental state you have to be that Rusty became a close friend to him and followed his, I quote, "teachings." Andrea and Rusty also molded their lives after Michael's. Michael had 6 children with biblical names, and we're going to see that they also did the same. And Michael's family lived in a bus.
I mean, he was a smart guy, so maybe they thought he was on to something.
Yeah. I was going to say, a lot of these televangelist people and stuff are very persuasive, and they sound smart. With that out of the way, the seemingly happy couple announced that they would seek to have as many babies as nature allowed, because this was also one of Michael's teachings, that you needed to spread the seed as much as you could. And they bought a 4-bedroom house in Friendswood, Texas. They had their first child. His name was Noah. He was born in February 1994, just before Rusty accepted a job offer in Florida, which they moved to Florida. They relocated to a small trailer in Seminole.
Native American name.
Seminole. By the time of the birth of the third child, whose name is Paul, they moved back to Houston and they purchased a motorhome.
I want to purchase a motorhome too.
I mean, motorhomes could be pretty freaking dope.
I would love one.
A double wide? They look like houses.
I mean, you could spend millions of dollars on a custom motorhome and live in it. Yes.
I think even $100,000 like motorhome would be pretty sweet.
I mean, it would be sweet, but in the world of like motorhomes and RVs, it's nothing. $100,000.
Yeah.
You can spend $80,000 on a pickup truck these days.
I don't know why they needed to be mobile, but
okay.
They like living in buses.
Right, back to the store.
But I agree. So mobile homes are really nice.
Okay, so they were living in buses?
Motorhomes.
Motorhomes.
Buses, whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In the early 2000s, I don't think there were like really nice ones like now. Anyways, going back to the story. Following the birth of their 4th child, Luke, Andrea became depressed for the first time. So the postpartum depression. On June 16th, 1999, Rusty found her shaking and chewing her fingers. The next day, she attempted to commit suicide by overdosing on pills. She was admitted to the hospital and prescribed antidepressants. Soon after her release, she begged Rusty to let her die as she held a knife up to her neck. He then took her back to the hospital and she was hospitalized. and she was giving a cocktail of medications, including Haldol, which is an antipsychotic drug, which helped tremendously. Her condition improved immediately, and she was prescribed this drug to stay on it upon her release. After that, Rusty moved the family into a small, like an actual small house for the sake of her health, and she appeared to be doing fine.
Appeared. I love that word.
Shortly after, in July, Andrea suffered a nervous breakdown. She tried two more suicide attempts.
Who doesn't love a good nervous breakdown?
Me.
I'm a little insensitive sometimes.
Just a little bit. But anyways, she tried two more suicide attempts, and that resulted in two more psychiatric hospitalizations. And then she was diagnosed with postpartum psychosis, because her symptoms are beyond what postpartum depression is. Andrea's first psychiatrist, her name was Dr. Eileen Starbranch. Dr. Eileen Starbranch.
Okay.
I know. Testified that she urged her and Rusty not to have any more children. Like, you need to stop having children because this is just going to make her condition worse. But of course, they conceived her fifth and final child approximately 7 weeks after her discharge. She stopped taking Haldol in March of 2000, and she gave birth to her daughter Mary on November 30th, 2000.
She's off the meds.
Yeah, once she got pregnant, she stopped taking the medication, her antipsychotic. She seemed to be coping well without the antipsychotic, and she was doing good with the baby. But that was up until the death of her father on March 12th of 2001. And you might wonder why she stopped drinking her medicine. And I think this is pretty common with people with mental issues. They just stop taking their medicine. And, you know, my mom and stuff. And they, unless you're like on their ass of taking their medicine, if they don't want to, they're not going to. And you just don't know until it's too late.
Yeah, sometimes it's an issue of the person is either forgetful or their mental issue like disallows them to remember to take their own medication.
Like, some my mom just like didn't think she needed it, and she stopped taking it. And I didn't know until, like, you know, shit hits the fan and you don't know. And maybe Rusty didn't know that
that's pride. Her pride got in the way of her health.
Yeah.
Take your medicine. You know, I understand not wanting to over-medicate yourself, though. I completely understand.
Yeah, and then if she suffered a triggering event like the death of her father, like, maybe she was doing fine, and that, like, a triggering event can set you back mentally, and then you just go on a mental bender, you know?
I will never understand, as a male, what postpartum depression or
psychosis
would ever be like,
or just like, well, me neither.
In my mind, I'm relating it to something similar to PTSD, only of a different nature.
Yeah, I can just say, because I've seen my mom go through what Andrea has gone through, like, in the mental state. My mom didn't have like the postpartum psychosis and stuff, just like other things. I can see how that train of events happened. Once Andrea stopped taking her medication, she began mutilating herself and reading the Bible obsessively, which is not good. She was so out of it at some point that she stopped feeding the new baby, Mary. She got so bad that, again, she required immediate hospitalization. On April 1st, she came under the care of Dr. Mohammed Saeed, and she was treated and released again. It wasn't long where, again, on May 3rd, she went back into a near catatonic state. She filled the bathtub that day, and she later confessed to police that she had planned to drown the children that day, but she didn't, and she decided against doing it. She was hospitalized the next day after a scheduled doctor's visit, where her psychiatrist determined that she was suicidal and that she had actually filled that bathtub to drown herself. So they didn't believe that she was going to drown the children, that she was just using that as a cover because she wanted to kill herself because she's been suicidal this whole time.
That's a terrible cover. Oh, I'm not going to kill just myself. I'm going to kill the children.
Yeah. I don't know why they like came into that conclusion, but that's what they thought.
Well, regardless, this lady needs to be watched.
Yeah, she does. And it's impressive that Rusty didn't give up on her. Like, he was taking her to the hospital and stuff. Like I said, up until what point do you have to monitor her, you know?
I think Rusty needed to step up and take the children out of there.
Yeah, but he was dedicated to Andrea. Well, like, he didn't want to give up.
Well, that's when you bring her to a hospital and you take care of your kids.
Yeah.
Even if she's using a cover. Oh, I was going to drown the children. That's no better, you crazy kook.
Yeah. Well, doesn't make a difference to me. It's not being sensitive. She's suffering from, like, an actual, like...
Oh. Yeah, but why does it make... It doesn't make sense that you would say that I would drown the children instead of killing myself.
Yeah, I think it's because she didn't have... She didn't show any aggression towards the kids. So when she said that, they're like, okay, no, like, you were trying to kill yourself. You're just saying this now so we don't think this and you don't have to be hospitalized. Couldn't she just said, like,
she let the bathtub overflow on accident instead of, oh, yeah, I was going to kill the kids. No, I wasn't going to kill myself.
I don't know why she said that and why.
Well, obviously, but yeah. Psychosis is a good point.
She continued under Dr. Saeed's care until June 20th of 2001. This is when Rusty left for work, leaving her alone to watch the children, as he has done. Dr. Saeed gave Rusty specific instructions to supervise her around the clock, especially around the children. So Rusty went against, you know, the doctor's word. Rusty told his mom to go check on Andrea an hour after he left for work so that she could take over and give Andrea a break. In that space of that hour that she was alone, Andrea drowned all 5 children.
Motherfucker.
Yeah. So Andrea started with John, and then Paul, and then Luke. And then she laid them in her bed after she was done. She then drowned Mary, whom she left floating in the tub. That's when Noah came in. And he was asking what was wrong with Mary because she was in the bathtub. He then noticed that something was wrong and he was trying to run away. But she caught him and then she drowned him too. She left him floating in the bathtub as she took Mary to the bed. After she was done drowning all the kids and putting them on the bed side by side, she called the police. And in the transcript, she was just saying repeatedly that she needed an officer to come to the house, but she would not say why. After she called the police, she hung up on them, and then she called Rusty and told him to come home right away. Andrea confessed to drowning her children. Prior to her second trial, she told Dr. Michael Wellner that she had waited for Rusty to leave for work that morning before filling the bathtub, because she knew that if she did it before he left, he would have, like, been like, why are you filling the bathtub?
Obviously.
Right. After the murders, police found that the family dog was locked up. And Rusty had said that usually the dog is running around the house free. So that was unusual. So this isn't the thing why they think this was premeditated, because Andrea locked the dog up so she didn't get in the way of drowning the kids.
Premeditated means murder one.
Yeah. Rusty got a family friend by the name of George Parnum to act as her attorney. Although the defense expert testimony agreed that Andrea was psychotic, Texas law requires that in order to successfully assert the insanity defense, the defendant must prove that he or she could not discern right from wrong at the time of the crime, which
is impossible if you lock the dog up ahead of time.
You locked the dog up, you waited until Rusty went to work, and you did it before the mom came.
She has no case.
In March of 2002, a jury rejected the insanity defense and found her guilty. Although the prosecution had sought the death penalty, the jury refused that option, which is a shame for Texas in this point, but...
Me too.
The trial court sentenced her to life imprisonment in the Texas Department of Criminal Justice with the eligibility for parole in 40 years, but you're going to be very angry what's about to happen. Later on June 6, 2005, a Texas Court of Appeals reversed the convictions because California psychiatrist and prosecution witness Dr. Park Dietz admitted that he had given materially false testimony during the trial.
No.
And it's so dumb.
What did he say? What did he do wrong?
In his testimony, this quote-unquote doctor had stated that shortly before the murders, an episode of Law & Order had aired featuring a woman who drowned her children and was acquitted of murder by reason of insanity. So he's saying that Andrea saw this, she got the idea, and she did it. Author and later Yale University lecturer Suzanne O'Malley was covering the trial for the Oprah Winfrey magazine and the New York Times, and also NBC News. She had previously been a writer for Law & Order, and immediately reported that that episode never existed. 2 years later, after the trial in 2004, is when Law & Order Criminal Intent did air an episode called The Magnificat, based on Yates' case. The appellate court held unanimously that the jury might have been influenced by the doctor's false testimony, and therefore a new trial would be necessary. On January 9th of 2006, Andrea again entered pleas for not guilty by reason of insanity. On February 1st, 2006, she was granted release on bail on the condition that she be admitted to a mental health treatment facility. Later that year, on July 26th, after 3 days of deliberations, Andrea was found not guilty by the reason of insanity as defined by the state of Texas. She was committed to North Texas State Hospital Vernon Campus. In January of 2007, she was moved to the Kerrville State Hospital. Kerrville is actually really pretty. A low-security mental facility in Kerrville, Texas, where she is still today, and she has not attempted once to be released, even though her case gets reviewed yearly. And there was a lot of controversy that surrounding this case, because when she murdered all of her children in the bathtub, and there was a lot of media attention on the case, and they were like saying since they found out that she was affiliated with Michael, the preacher guy, they were saying that she was influenced by Michael's teachings and that that's why she killed her children. They alleged that Michael had some sort of responsibility for the deaths due to his certain teachings, which were found in a newsletter titled The Perilous Times, which the Yates have received in occasion, and which was entered into evidence at the trial. In the aftermath of 2006 retrial, which had resulted in the insanity verdict, Chris Cuomo, the reporter guy from ABC, stated that Andrea Yates' delusions were fueled by the extreme religious beliefs of a bizarre street preacher, which is Michael. Later, both Rusty and Michael have always been rejecting these accusations. Rusty said that the family's relationship with the Wernickis wasn't even that close, that they weren't really like that friendly, which is lies, but they were saying that that was not true. And Michael said that he didn't really interfere or like went out of his way to teach anything malicious to the Yates, and that he was just trying to give them some sort of like marriage counseling to like help their marriage and blah blah blah.
They were buddy buddy.
They were buddy buddies for sure. There was no evidence to be able to convict like neither of them, and like Michael was not found to be a part of this. It was all like Andrea.
Well, it is all Andrea at the end of the day.
Both men agreed that the alleged connection between his message and her mental state was nothing more than media-created fiction. While in prison, Andrea did state that she had considered killing the children for 2 years before she actually did. This is, I think, where some of this is coming from. She was saying that she thought that she wasn't a good mom, and she was claiming that her sons were developing improperly. She told her jail psychiatrist, "It was the seventh deadly sin. My children weren't righteous. They stumbled because I was evil. The way I was raising them, they could never be saved. They were doomed to perish in the fires of hell." And that's why she did it. So whether this was influenced by Michael or not, like, who knows?
Well, it certainly sounds like it.
But a lot of people that suffer from mental issues, they like
say things like that.
They are, I don't know why they go to the Bible and they like get extremely like religious, they like get that
vicious about it.
Mm-hmm. And that's that. She's still in jail. Well, not in jail, she's in the Kerrville Mental Institute,
a psych ward,
yeah, for life. And as far as Rusty goes, he was staying put with Andrea, who was very supportive through the whole case. He didn't think that she did it like maliciously, that it was all from her mental state. He did eventually get divorced from her, and 2 years later, he remarried and had a son with someone else, but that didn't last long because they also ended up getting divorced. And
oh, Rusty.
I didn't, like, look what happened to Rusty and stuff.
Well, he was probably scarred up, too, from his past relationship.
Yeah.
All his 5 children are gone.
Mm-hmm.
And he was dealing with Michael, too.
Yeah, Michael, and he seemed like he loved Andrea and everything, so he also lost his wife. It's sad. And yeah, that's the end of my Texas story.
That was awesome. Thank you.
You liked it?
Yeah, I did like it.
Not that you liked it, but it's crazy.
No, it was a good story, mm-hmm. and you told it well.
Now I'm excited for your story.
Yeah, mine's, like I said, it's from my hometown.
Okay.
Tewksbury, Massachusetts.
Very specific.
Yes, and it goes back to the late 60s now.
Oh, okay.
Because not a lot happens here.
No, it's very peaceful and safe here.
I had to go back in time for some juicy information.
Yeah, for the next mini monster-sode, I'll like actually do a hometown.
And I won't.
And you won't.
The boy's name was John Joseph McCabe. He was born on March 13th, 1954, and he died at the young age of 15.
Aw, baby.
September 27th, 1969. He was a young man from Tewksbury who was abducted and murdered after attending a Knights of Columbus dance in Lowell, Massachusetts, the town over. So he was a 15-year-old boy dancing his night away.
Yeah.
He was having fun.
To summer of 69.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, that was probably an awesome time to be 15 years old.
I wonder if that song actually came out in 69.
I feel like that song came out in the 80s.
Oh.
We'll fact check it.
Okay.
Steph can get back to us on that song. Anyway, his father, William, spent the next 4 decades searching for his son's killers. Or killer.
Yeah.
Cut to the chase. 15-year-old Johnny was bound and gagged and left to die in a field.
Oh, no.
Jump to the end. I'm going crazy on you.
Okay.
Stick with me.
Yeah.
Jump to the end. An emotional impact statement was read in court before sentencing, which read, "Dad lived life to find out who killed Johnny and why." William, his father, who died in 2013 at the age of 85, didn't live long enough to see one of his son's killers, Walter Shelley, who was 62, led away in handcuffs from Lowell Superior Court after being sentenced to life in prison.
Wow.
His father, again, before passing away, had been quoted, "His life and ours were ruined," talking about Johnny, his son.
Mm-hmm.
Terrible. Terrible. I'm in the feels already. I'm getting, like, goosebumps because it's fucked up.
I always hate that when parents lose their children and they live a life hoping they find out who did it and they never do. They hardly ever do.
That's all he wanted.
Aw, but at least they got caught.
Those are the stories where people's lives are cut short because they're just heartbroken
mm-hmm.
and they can't go on.
Yeah.
That's sad. The case went cold for more than 4 decades until Lowell Police Detective Jerry Wayne reopened it, cracking the case in 2011 with the arrests of Shelley, Michael Ferreira of Salem, New Hampshire, and Edward Allen Brown of Londonderry, New Hampshire.
Mm.
Brown, 61 years old at the time, in the Air Force for 30 years, a veteran. He risked his freedom to confess to McCabe's murder.
Wow, it was him who confessed?
Yes. Brown named his Tewksbury friends at the time, Ferreira and Shelley, as participating in the plot to teach McCabe what is in quotes, a lesson for flirting with Shelley's girlfriend.
Oh.
Yep.
Mm.
The girl's name was Marla Shiner.
Miss Marla.
In exchange for his testimony at the trial, Ferreira and Shelley trials,
mm-hmm.
his two buddies, Brown will plead guilty to manslaughter and serve no time in jail.
The guy that reported them.
The guy that reported them, the Air Force veteran.
The Air Force guy, the only one with a conscience.
Went 4 decades without telling anyone.
Not good.
He must have...
He should be stripped from being a veteran.
Maybe he felt God in him.
We all feel God at some point. We confess to everything.
He was getting old and it was his time.
Yeah.
It probably ate him up. Who knows? I don't know. After a multi-week trial in January of 2013, Michael Ferreira was found not guilty of first-degree murder.
What?
During Shelley's trial, Brown testified that hours before the murder, Ferreira and Shelley allegedly picked up Brown at his Tewksbury home, telling him they wanted to get McCabe because he was flirting with Marla. There was a conflicting testimony about whether Shelley and Shiner were dating or not, even.
Yeah, so he probably just liked Marla, and he was upset that McCabe was flirting with her to begin with.
very good.
But that's so dumb.
It is dumb.
Don't be flirting with the girl that I like.
Don't be flirting with the girl I like.
Well, I guess when you're teenagers, you do say stuff like that. I remember.
You do.
I remember telling my friends, like, no, I call dibs on whoever.
Yeah. Like, and I mean, it was a different time back then, I guess.
Yeah, that too. Do you know if McCabe was his friend or he was just like some boy?
He was just another boy at school.
Oh.
McCabe was not friends with the three other boys.
Oh, okay. So McCabe didn't even know.
From what I know?
No, yeah. From what the information that we have?
Exactly.
He didn't... It seems like McCabe didn't even know that Brown... Or no, that the other boy liked Marla.
Yeah.
Okay. Or maybe he did know and he still flirted and that's why he got beat up. Too many scenarios. Continue.
Well, they all could be possible, and there's nothing wrong with thinking any of that because that's just how it goes sometimes. Yeah. But Shelley was the one who was the real ringleader. It was his name. His last name was Shelley.
Shelley.
After driving around Tewksbury, the trio spotted McCabe hitchhiking home from the Knights of Columbus dance that I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. He was having fun
with Marla.
I mean, that really would have pissed him off, right?
Yeah.
They allegedly forced him into the back seat, and Ferreira began assaulting the teenager. They stopped at a vacant field off of Maple Street in Lowell, where Ferreira allegedly used his pocket knife to cut rope that was used to tie McCabe's ankles and wrists, and a rope from his neck to his ankles.
No.
Then, Ferreira muttered something about messing with Marla, as Brown testified in court. Brown also testified in court. The last time he saw McCabe alive, the boy was laying on his belly with his legs up in the air due to the rope being tied from his ankles to his neck.
Did he die by accident?
He's laying there hogtied.
Yeah.
We'll get to that.
Okay.
O'Reilly said that as McCabe struggled to free himself, the rope inadvertently tightened slowly around his neck, choking him worse and worse.
Mm.
So yeah, you're right there.
It was either that or the boys got so into the crime that, you know, the devil got inside of them and, like, killed him. But
I don't think so. I think it was an accident.
No, yeah.
After 45 minutes, the car full of boys decided to go back and that they thought he had learned his lesson by that point.
He was dead.
Returning to the scene, Brown said Shelley and Ferreira got out of the car and went over to McCabe. They knelt over him and then quickly returned to the car. As they drove away, Brown testified Ferreira and Shelley were frantic, telling him he's not breathing. Realizing that McCabe was now dead, they were in some hot shit.
Mm-hmm.
They did not mean to kill him.
No, I know. Yeah.
And because of this, they made a pact to never tell anyone.
Oh my God.
And that's what they did for 40 years.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that?
No, I couldn't live. I can't live with secrets. I can't even imagine, like, killing someone by accident. It's crazy.
Shelley received a concurrent 9 to 10 year prison sentence for his conviction of intimidation of a witness.
So they didn't even...
That's making the pact. Intimidation of a witness they're referring to. Yeah. Let's not tell anyone. He got 10 years for agreeing to not tell anyone, even though he wasn't the one that tied, you know?
Mm-hmm.
McCabe's family wrote in their impact statement that they are not vindictive, but we want justice to prevail. Because neither Ferreira nor Shelley testified at their trials, the McCabe family filed a $10 million wrongful death lawsuit against Shelley, Ferreira, and Brown. As part of the civil action, Ferreira and Shelley were required to give depositions under oath. They wanted them in court, face-to-face. Evelyn McCabe, John's mother, told the Lowell Sun newspaper that it isn't about the money. It's so that the family can learn what happened and why, fulfilling William McCabe's dying wish.
How would they even get that money? Where do you come up with $10 million? Like, you can sue me all you want. Like, I don't have $10 million.
A wrongful death lawsuit? You'd have to go to a lawyer and find out where that money coming from, baby.
Yeah.
So as I said earlier, he was bound with rope around his throat and his ankles. His eyes and his mouth had been taped shut. And now, a medical examiner ruled that McCabe died by asphyxiation from strangulation.
Mm.
O'Reilly, one of the boys that did this to him, said that McCabe struggled to free himself, making it worse, and that the last vision that he had of the boy was the tape covering his eyes and him gasping for his own breath.
Ugh.
That's gross.
Can you imagine taped up with duct tape, your mouth, your eyes, you don't even know, you can't breathe, and you're strangling yourself all at once.
Right.
Tied up. Yeah.
It's pretty fucked up, not gonna lie. I mean, how can you strangle somebody with a rope and then just leave them there in a field?
Yeah, well, they didn't think they were strangling him.
Well,
but
they did.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're going to talk about the sentencing of the final guy. The guy who's really getting everything pinpointed on him.
Freaking Shelley.
Shelley.
Mm-hmm.
Because Brown and Ferreira got off easy. Brown is the one who brought the case up to everyone after 40 years.
He gets immunity.
Ferreira is testifying to a bunch of other information as well. He's getting immunity. And
so far, no one's getting what they deserve, for sure.
Nope.
What happens to Shelley then?
This is what happens to Shelley, and I'll tell you. While a first-degree murder conviction usually does not allow for parole, under a new state law based on U.S. Supreme Court decision, anyone 17 or younger at the time of the crime cannot be sentenced to life without parole.
He was underage.
I don't like it either. He's 17. He's close enough.
Yeah.
As a result, because Shelley was 17 on September 27th, 1969, when John McCabe's body was discovered, he will be eligible for parole after 15 years. So 15 years from the sentencing date, which was in 2013 or 14. I can look it up to be exact. But that's going to put him eligible for parole 2027-2028 time frame.
Yeah.
So not too far off from now.
No.
And he got to live his whole life out of prison anyway.
Yeah, all his good years were, like, put to use.
What's 15 years? That's the length of time that John even lived, was 15 years.
That's so sad.
Put it that way. Defense attorney Stephen Naiman asked the judge to dismiss the case on the grounds that the Superior Court lacked jurisdiction. Judge Janet Kenton Walker denied the motion, said, nah.
Mm-hmm.
First-degree murder convictions come with automatic appeal to the state's highest court. He was sentenced to life.
Yeah.
It's fucked up, though, that parole thing.
It is, because they're probably going to feel bad for him because he's old, and they're going to let him out.
It doesn't mean he's going to get out, but...
It doesn't, but I don't know his criminal history since then, but if he was a good citizen, blah, 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 like, they probably will let him go.
The sentencing came after prosecutor Thomas O'Reilly said the defendants cut short the life of a 15-year-old boy with no apparent remorse and no apparent fear of being caught.
Hmm. That's terrible. I can't believe that happened here.
That's a crazy story.
It is crazy. It's really sad and, like, unnecessary.
Yeah.
I wish there was information about, like, when Marla... thought of this, because it was all her fault.
And to think 10 years ago from now, this was still a cold case.
Yeah, that's so sad, but I'm glad it got solved. Sad that the dad of McCabe didn't get to see this happen, but I wonder if other family members, you said the family members were suing them.
The family members were suing them, but unfortunately Johnny's father, who devoted the 40 years after that, trying to find out why and who killed his son.
Did it say anything about McCabe's mom?
Well, she's the one who's pulling out the lawsuit for $10 million because she wants justice for her son. And now she wants justice for her deceased husband, who spent the rest of his life trying to find the murderers.
I'm glad at least one of his parents was able to see justice being partly served.
His mom was able to see justice served.
To only one of them.
Without the other two, they wouldn't have got one. And without Brown, at least, I don't want to say Brown is a good guy.
No.
Because he can't.
Mm-mm.
But maybe he's better.
Tiny bit. He came forth. Well, that's a hell of a story.
And so was yours.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to us.
It ended up not being such a mini monster-sode, but the next one will be.
Well, you can break it in half and anything is a mini episode if you just hit stop. But
that is true.
Hit play again and come back.
We'll see you later, monsters.
Bye.
Bye.
Love you.
I love you. Bye.